Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
Welcome to NHPR's Candidate Forum for the 2nd Congressional District. I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange, along with NHPR reporter Casey McDermott. For the next hour, we'll question the Republican and Democratic candidates for Congress, Republican State Representative Steve Negron, and Democratic incumbent Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. Candidates will have 60 seconds to answer each question. Often there'll be a follow-up question or point of clarification from Casey or me, which will receive 30 seconds. And we'd like to begin with opening statements, a chance for candidates to make their case to voters. We'll go in alphabetical order, so Congresswoman Custer, welcome, and go ahead, please.
Well, thank you, Laura. It's wonderful to be here. I want to thank NHPR for this great civic opportunity. I want to thank my Mr. Negron, for accepting our commitment to civility, and I think we'll have an interesting discussion today. When I went to Congress, I promised a new approach, and that was bringing people together to get things done. I think of it as the New Hampshire way. It's a very bipartisan district, and I've tried to work in a bipartisan way, bringing people together, 105 members of Congress, to work on a task force that I created on the opioid epidemic. I've worked across the lines on the Veterans Affairs Committee and on the Farm Bill and the Agriculture Committee, and recently with a brand new task force on Republicans and Democrats working together to end sexual violence. So I'll look forward to the discussion, and thanks for having us.
Well, and thank you. And Representative Negron, your turn. Go ahead. Thank you also for being here.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Laura and Casey, for being here and for everybody that's in the audience. It's a pleasure to be here. And again, it's an honor and a privilege to share the stage with Congresswoman Custer. You know, this is probably the most significant election we've had in our lifetime that's coming up here. And it's very important that we take the situations that we've seen over the last 6 years with Congresswoman Custer and what we're seeing today in Washington, that it is an important time for us to make a decision as to where we want to move this country forward. You know, I bring a different perspective. I am Hispanic. I'm a veteran. I'm a small business owner. I'm a community leader. And I think those are the kind of voices that we need to hear in Washington. And I think it's important that we have an opportunity to hear both sides, keep an open mind that's out there, because it's up to you that's going to decide. And so I'm really excited about being here. And if I may say something in Spanish, a toda la gente que están escuchando, muy buenos días. Gracias.
All right. Thank you. And let's get into our questions. The order of questioning was decided by an earlier coin toss. So, Representative Negron, you won that coin toss, so you'll go first.
Is that a good thing?
I'll let you decide. I want to start off with some international affairs. As you both know, a bipartisan chorus of lawmakers is calling for possible sanctions, including arms sales to Saudi Arabia, after the mysterious disappearance and presumed murder of U.S.-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. If you were in Congress, Representative Negron, would you be joining this group calling for possible sanctions?
Well, the first thing, I think there are two words that you use were important, is presumed and possible. I mean, you know, we are a country that has due process, and we need to make sure that we follow that regardless whether it's within the borders of our country or abroad. And so if there are some things that are out there that that we should be looking into, I'm all for that, absolutely. What I wouldn't do is do what we did during the Kavanaugh hearings and rush to judgment. You know, we have an opportunity here to listen. We do know that the Saudis are our allies, but if during the due course of due process, we find that there are situations that merit us putting sanctions against any entity, then I think that's what we should do. But we shouldn't rush to judgment. You know, we shouldn't have this pack mentality that we saw during the Kavanaugh hearings, that all of a sudden we want to rush to judgment and convict something or someone. But if, in fact, there is something out there that's a legitimate issue, then I would absolutely go ahead and support that.
Congresswoman Custer, where do you stand on this issue of possible sanctions against Saudi Arabia?
Well, the First Amendment and the protection of journalists around the globe is one of the most important values that we hold. And I think particularly given the last 2 years of the Trump administration, journalism has really risen to the task of keeping people honest. And it's a big challenge with this president. He's already gone out and talked about rogue groups that may have harmed this journalist. And I think what we're hearing is that the Saudis are about to come forward and recognize and tell the world that he was murdered, in fact, murdered and dismembered during an interrogation in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. I think it's outrageous, and I think Congress should act, and I think we should have sanctions.
I want to pivot to an issue that I know you are hearing a lot about from constituents here in New Hampshire, and that's about the economy. And Representative Negron, the number one complaint that we hear from New Hampshire businesses is workforce. Just yesterday, I talked to a tourism official who said some hospitality businesses in her region wanted to stay open until Columbus Day, had to close on Labor Day because of a lack of employees. Wow, that's a lot of lost opportunity there. What congressional role do you see, if any, in bolstering New Hampshire's workforce?
Absolutely. You know, we hear that New Hampshire has one of the lowest unemployment, but I myself, when I've been talking to small businesses, and I'm being a small business owner myself, we hear that there is an issue out there with bringing in some seasonal workers to do those things that you're talking about. Our visa program needs to absolutely be relooked at and revamped. You know, there are situations we are actually hindering small businesses from doing stuff. I talked to an individual that owns a significant amount of Dunkin' Donut franchises, and what he has had to do is actually close some and put them all together in one so that he has enough workforce to do that. So, you know, when you look at the type of people that want to come in here, and we have a process to do that, we need to look at how do we help the small businesses in New Hampshire. But the only way we do that is by going out there and listening to them, knocking on their door, sitting down, having a cup of coffee, and seeing how the government can help them by allowing the right type of people to come in to help them with their businesses.
So you mentioned the visas, and as you know, many New Hampshire businesses, especially in hospitality, are calling for a higher level of H-2B visas.
Right.
These allow the temporary workers,
yes,
as you mentioned. So if you were elected to Congress, Representative Negron, would you support increasing the number of H-2B visas?
Absolutely. See, what happened was it was up, I think the number was 30,000, and prior, you know, that 30,000, if you had people that were there, then they were automatically entered into to having an H-2B visa. The problem became is that this year it all started from zero. The reason why visas are so important and why I'm a proponent of it is that it's a national security issue for me. When you come into this country, I need to know who you are, where you're staying, what your duration, and what purpose. So I'm not talking about just an open border kind of thing that other people want to talk about. It is calculated, it's collected, you know, and if I know where somebody is already, then we need to keep on doing that as well.
So the H-2B program, you feel, satisfies those security requirements?
Yes, ma'am.
A different economic question for you, Congresswoman Custer. As you know, the unemployment rate in the U.S. is now at its lowest level since 1969, 3.7% nationally, even lower here in New Hampshire. There's an old saying that Americans often vote with their wallets in mind. So if that's the case, shouldn't they vote Republican this year?
Absolutely not. And I'm very surprised, actually, by Mr. Negron's answer, because I would have passed comprehensive immigration reform that passed the Senate 5.5 years ago. Kelly Ayotte voted for it, John McCain, Senator Shaheen, 2/3 of the Senate. And yet the House of Representatives under Republican leadership has not held a single hearing. And in fact, they're cutting back on visas. What we need is to expand the H-2B program, absolutely, for seasonal workers. We need farm workers. I was on a dairy farm just the other day where they can't get the workers that they need. And we need to expand opportunity for legal immigration, and yet the Republicans flat out refuse to do that. And it's harming our economy right here in New Hampshire. We've got the second lowest unemployment in the country, and we need to make sure that people have the opportunity and that businesses have the workers that they need.
Well, to the unemployment rate, though, my question is, if Republicans are going to run for Congress this year saying, look at the unemployment rate, look at all the good things that are happening in the economy, wages are rising, lowest unemployment rate since 1969, how can Democrats make the case, yeah, that's fine, but we'll do even better?
Because we will do better. We will do job training. That's what we need in the workforce. And all of these cuts by the Trump administration, by the positions that Mr. Negron takes to cut back the government, they get in the way of education. Just look at Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education and the privatization. What we need to do is invest in people. And what I've been doing is visiting our career and technical high schools, our community colleges, bringing in federal money, the grants that we brought to Nashua Community College for advanced manufacturing and for microelectronic programs, so that people get the training so that they can get better wages, have a better life.
On the immigration question, Casey McDermott has a question on immigration, so I'll set that aside for now. But Mr. Negron, what about the cuts that the Trump administration has proposed to educational programs such as community colleges and so forth? Will those hurt workforce development?
Well, I think when you look at what the workforce development is and what exactly are we talking about, you know, I believe, and I don't know when it happened in this country, that those kind of trades that were good trades in the 40s and 50s and 60s, such as electricians and plumbers and carpenters, somewhere along the line, we've lost our way to say that, you know, that's a good trade. It's a good way to start a family and to start a business. So, you know, when we talk about what the education cuts is, I believe education resides with the state. I believe that we as a state legislature, and I think that's a perspective that Congresswoman Custer hasn't had being a state legislator, we understand what we need for our state. I shouldn't have big government telling me what I need to do when it comes to educating my my constituents. And so I would work in conjunction with the state and see what it is that they need to make sure that they have the right education program.
Okay. Let's move on to immigration, and you, Casey McDermott.
Congresswoman Custer, just a year ago, you were one of a handful of Democrats to support measures targeting undocumented immigrants with criminal records and relaxing hiring standards for Customs and Border Patrol agents. At the time, you explained your position in part by saying you didn't want to open yourself up to potential attacks from political opponents. What do you say now to voters who might question the sincerity of your positions on the issue?
Well, as I said, I would absolutely support comprehensive immigration reform. That was a setup issue that the Republican leadership for races like mine. And the reality is that we do need strong borders, and I support strong borders. But I think we need a pathway to citizenship, and we need to take care of the dreamers. And over and over and over, the Republican leadership, and Mr. Negron would fall right in line with them, is blocking a legal pathway and the family separation issue. I had to go down to the border because that's un-American. It was tragic, and it hurts our view, the view of Americans all around the world. So I think we do need a honest debate on immigration. We need to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And again, it's been 5.5 years and the Republican leadership does nothing about it. So I'm hopeful that the Democrats will win back the House. I think we will. And then we can move forward on this comprehensive immigration reform, get a pathway to citizenship, and the people of New Hampshire will have the employees to do the work that is so important here.
Representative Negron, you have spoken at length about your family's immigration history, including your grandfather's journey from Mexico and his path to citizenship. You've said that he came over, quote, the right way.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you propose dealing with the thousands of migrants who are crossing the border because they're fleeing violence in their home countries?
Well, you know, you can't mix immigration with asylum. And I think when people are fleeing for violence, it's a different story. You know, I find it interesting that somebody wants to sit on the stage and talk to me who's 100% Hispanic about what we go through trying to get into this country. And, you know, there's a majority, and I say the majority of Hispanics that are out here that say, you know what, I don't like other Hispanics coming in here illegally either. But nobody wants to talk about that. Like, we're a land of laws. There's a right way to do it. We're not doing it, and we need to get back to it. And I take umbrage when people try to paint me or any of the Republicans that say that we're anti-immigration. I'm 100% Hispanic, and my grandfather came here from Mexico, so I'm 100% immigration. It is that, you know, we have to absolutely make sure that people follow the process. For those people that have true asylum issues, we need to understand what those are and address those outside of the immigration issue. But you know what? There's a right way to come in here. People want to do it. They wait. As a matter of fact, a young woman that I knew from Portugal, after 22 years, she became a citizen. And we need to be careful. Not everybody wants to become a citizen. You know, there's 185 ways to come into this country. And we need to make sure that those people that are coming, we know who they are.
And just as a follow-up on that, talking specifically on the immigration side,
yes,
there's an estimated 11 million or so immigrants who did come here illegally who are living in the country right now, many working in our economy.
Right.
How do you propose dealing with that very large group of people?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I think what you have to look at is that, okay, you take that populace and figure out, all right, not everybody gets to get 20 years to decide whether or not they want to be a citizen. It's not that these rules were unknown to them. They absolutely knew what those rules were. And you can't just wake up on the 20th year and go, oh, no, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. So I think there's a way to make sure that we identify who those are, tell, you know, the process and how you want to become, if you want to become a citizen, and if you don't want to follow the rules that we put in place, then I think you have an opportunity to go back to your country. And if you want to come back, start the process all over.
Congressman Custer, I could see you wanted a quick follow-up to something Representative Negron said there.
The quick follow-up is that the people coming across the border when their families were separated were seeking asylum, and they were blocked from seeking asylum. They were made out to be criminals. They were put in detention. They were sent to Seattle and all over the country. Their children were sent to New England and upstate New York and all these different places, and I didn't hear a peep out of Senator Mr. Negron about that abhorrent policy that is contrary to our American values. I think it was shocking, and I think it should be illegal.
Well, I'll give you 30 seconds, Representative Negron, to clarify what you said about asylum versus coming here illegally, because you seem to have some sympathy for asylum. The Trump administration has had a tougher line on that.
Sure. Well, asylum is very specific, and it's outside of immigration. And you can't, when you merge the two, I think it becomes cloudier. You know, we have very specific rules within the State Department what asylum is. And if you're trying to seek asylum, then there's some wickets that you have to go through. You know, the laws that we were actually enforcing were laws that have been on the books for years. So it isn't something that Republicans just started to do. And I think it's a bit disingenuous.
In terms of the separation of families,
I think it's disingenuous about being able to label it and throwing it at our feet. To do that, we have families here in the United States that get separated because of violating the law. So it really isn't any different. And when our president found out about it, he signed an executive order to try and curtail that. So I think there was some empathy from part of this administration.
Well, we're going to move on to another issue very important here in New Hampshire, and that's the opioid crisis. And as both of you know, the death toll from drug overdose continues to rise. 488 Granite Staters last year, more than one person a day. Congressman Custer, as you well know, Congress approved $45 million to help New Hampshire combat opioid addiction. How confident are you that this money will lead to a reduction in those overdose deaths?
Well, first, I want to say we fought hard for that money, and I was instrumental in getting a formula so that New Hampshire and West Virginia and states that were hardest hit did get more funding. I think it's the beginning. It's not the end. At the height of the AIDS crisis, we were spending hundreds of millions of dollars. And so the fact is that we need more. We need education and prevention. Most importantly, we need to increase access to treatment. That's been our biggest problem here in New Hampshire. And we need to recognize it's not just a 28-day one-and-done proposition. This is a chronic illness, substance use disorder, and we need recovery housing. And we need to make sure that law enforcement has the tools that they need. And that's why I sponsored legislation about fentanyl and synthetic opioids. But listen, I think it's a start, but we're not done. And I look forward to the work with my task force to find bipartisan solutions and to find the funding to solve the problem.
Well, people in New Hampshire were cheering that this money was coming in, but some said, hey, you know, it's been a long time coming. You've been in office for 6 years. Why did it take so long for this money to come through?
Well, you'd have to ask the Trump administration. We passed these bills. The first round was in 2016, and the second round was in 2018. The president's been talking the talk, but not walking the walk. He had a task force that came up with nothing. And so this is what we've done in Congress. And as I say, it's the beginning, and there's more to be done. But look, it's a Republican leadership. It's Paul Ryan is our speaker, and they brought forth nothing. We had to do this in a bipartisan way with Democratic leadership to make sure that the job got done.
Well, and Representative Negron, a different question for you on opioids. Many in the treatment and recovery field have said that New Hampshire's Medicaid expansion has been a critical tool for fighting addiction because it expands treatment coverage to those who couldn't afford it before. And as you know, the program passed the legislature with Republican support, including the leadership of the Senate. You voted against it. How come?
Well, when I looked at it and I looked at the totality of it, I looked at it as a tax, and I'm not a tax and spend kind of guy. I certainly do appreciate the issue that we have with the opioid crisis. As a matter of fact, I have an opioid roundtable this afternoon to talk about those. And I think what you have to do is you can't do this from Washington. You have to come down here. You have to talk to the people that are providing the treatment. You have to talk to the individuals that are stricken with this disease and to find out what is working, what is not working. You know, I have a charge nurse that's a friend of mine at Mass General, and they're finding great promise with using some hemp, and not the THC side, but I think it's called the LHC, that shows a great promise for pain management, but it's not so addictive. So I think we need to look at some things and outside of the box to be able to provide what we need to do to help this Granite Staters go ahead and address this issue.
Okay, we have to head into a break, so maybe we'll spend a little more time on that after a short break. Thank you, both of you. And we will be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Dedicated listener Joanne Harden of Rye has included NHPR in her will and trust. It may not be the biggest trust, but I want to be able to pay back what I feel I've received so the people coming after me will be able to enjoy that.
Leaving a gift to NHPR is an inspired way to support an organization that has enriched your life and that of others in your community. To learn more about including NHPR in your estate plans, go to nhpr.giftplans.org.
Welcome back to our candidate forum on New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Casey McDermott, and this hour we're talking with the Republican and Democratic nominees, State Representative Steve Negron and incumbent Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. And just before the break, we were talking about the opioid crisis and Representative Negron. I did want to give you another 30 seconds or so to respond to my question about why you didn't support Medicaid expansion when many people, including Republicans, say this has been a critical tool for combating addiction here in the state.
Sure. Well, thank you, Laura. As I said earlier, you know, when we looked at the totality of that bill, it was just a tax. The way we looked at it, you know, we understand, and all Republicans in the current state house understand that this is an issue that we need to attack. But I think we need to be doing more. I think, you know, when you look at how treatment is and we're treating opioid addiction with an opioid, just doesn't pass the sanity check for me. So we need to look at advancements, and we need to hold the pharmas accountable. We need to bring them on task and make sure that they're doing what they need to do to try to provide, if they're going to do opioids, that something that's not so, dependent leading. And I think that we have to be responsible from that perspective to do that.
So it sounds like you're not a fan of medication-assisted treatment in what you just said there.
Well, I am. If, in fact, this comes, so I believe like Medicaid that comes down or any kind of money that's coming down to $42 million over the next 2 years. But there has to be some rules of engagement on what we're using it. You know, what I was talking to somebody who has 7 treatment centers, that none of that money is going to him. You know, so we need to make sure that if federal money is coming down, that we have some sort of wherewithal to work with the state legislature and the governor and executive council to make sure it's going to those places that absolutely do need it.
Okay, Congresswoman Custer, 30 seconds, please.
Well, just to make the point that 52,000 people finally had health insurance coverage and could access medication and treatment for opioid disorder, and Mr. Negron voted no. He's also opposed to the Affordable Care Act that brings treatment and access. People need mental health treatment as well. 4 out of 5 heroin users have a co-occurring mental health disorder. And if you go to any treatment facility in the state, they're going to say to you, having access to coverage and health care is critically important, and you can't solve this problem without it.
Let's move on to another topic. And Casey McDermott, back to you, please.
Congresswoman Custer, according to ProPublica, you've sponsored 25 bills during this most recent term, but just 3 of those have made it out of committee. How can you assure voters that you will be an effective representative if reelected?
Well, the point is that I work in a bipartisan way, and we've had dozens of bills passed into law by President Trump. So it's not having my name on it is not the most important thing. The most important thing is working together. The Veterans Affairs Committee has been the most prolific committee. We've gotten 80 bills out, 22 signed into law by the president. I was very proud to be one of 2 Democrats on the Mission Act, the VA Mission Act, to extend coverage, particularly here in New Hampshire, working with Senator Sullivan to make sure that New Hampshire citizens and veterans get access to treatment in the community. And I attended the signing ceremony at the White House. So that's what's important, getting the Farm Bill done in a bipartisan way, and working on the opioid epidemic, passing 54 bills that came out of my task force in June that's now part of the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act going to the president for his signature. That's what's important, is getting the job done.
And this is a follow-up question from a listener along those lines. What was your first piece of legislation that you submitted when you got to D.C.?
Well, there were dozens of bills. There wasn't any one in particular. It's working on my committees and working with my colleagues. One of the bills that was a missed opportunity in the tax bill, and have in mind it's a Republican leadership, we have a bill that would provide a tax incentive for small businesses and companies to provide training and job workforce development. And that is something that will be the first bill that we introduce in January in the Democratic administration, and we'll get it into law.
Now on to you, Representative Negron. According to records from the New Hampshire House, you've not sponsored any bills during your term in the legislature. Can you explain why?
Absolutely. You know, just to put in legislation for legislation's sake isn't the right thing to do. I think you need to sit back and find out, you latch up to somebody who becomes your mentor to figure out, you know, just because you don't submit legislation doesn't mean you don't actively work on bills, promote bills. So it was really as a foot soldier in my first term in the House. I did a lot of work for both Democratic bills and Republican bills, and so that's why I did it. I just sat back and, you know, just to put something in to say you did it is really not a measure of success.
Can you give an example of one of those bills that you were a foot soldier for?
Oh, sure. So I was on the election law committee, which was a very spirited committee over the last two sessions. And there were some votes on there that came out 20-0 that were both bipartisan, you know, and it was also about, I was also the whip for the election law committee. So my job and my responsibility was to make sure that we either got people on board or to bring them over. And so that's what it is. So I worked across the aisles for both of those because we both had Democratic and Republicans on the committee.
And how would you assure voters then that you'd be able to effectively advocate for policies on their behalf or sponsor policies on their behalf in Washington without that corresponding experience at the state level?
Sure. So what I would do is the first thing you have to do is that the people that we represent in the 2nd Congressional District know that you're listening, that you come back here, that you effectively go all the way up to Coos County and you listen to what they have. And you have truly town hall meetings where you actually have to fold chairs and sit in barns and where it's cold in the winter and hot in the summer. Those are the kind of things. And that's when they know fundamentally that you are listening and that you're taking that clear, crisp New Hampshire water to Washington, then they know that you're fighting on their behalf.
Thank you both. And Casey, our next question also comes from you, continuing on this political theme.
And we'll go back to you, Representative.
Yes.
Let's talk about the political climate right now. We've seen a wave of protest on the left recently, a movement that some Republicans have characterized as an out-of-control mob. How are these protests that we're seeing from the resistance movement today different from the ones that we've seen from the right in the past, such as the Tea Party in 2010?
Sure. Well, first of all, civil protest is a bedrock of our country. We've seen that. But what we've seen over the last couple of weeks really is I characterize it as violence. It isn't protesting. When you chase people into restaurants and you get in their face, you know, there's a way to actually demonstrate and put a position forward. But what we saw during the Kavanaugh hearings, right, where people, even before the hearing started, were just there to be disruptive. They weren't there to provide any sort of civility, any kind of alter kind of position. And that's not what we're about. That's not what this country is about. And I don't care if you're Democrat. I don't care if you're Republican. If that's how you feel that you have to get your voice heard, then you need to look at yourself and internally and figure out what's your position that you want to put forward. Look, we were embarrassed as a country when we looked at the Kavanaugh hearings. And I've walked over 27,000 doors, and what I hear from people after the Kavanaugh hearing was they were ashamed. They were ashamed that that's the way that we have to go ahead and find good discourse. So I believe it's wrong. I believe spirited discussion is good. I think disagreement is good. But the way that the left carried out this way was almost embarrassing. And I have friends that live all over the world, and they kept on asking me, how did that happen? And I didn't have an answer for them.
And just one more follow-up for you. During the Republican primary, you said that the scandals surrounding the Trump administration have no bearing on your campaign.
Right.
And instead, you and the voters of the 2nd District are focused on policy issues. At the same time, those scandals are the subject of ongoing congressional oversight. If elected, what oversight role, if any, do you believe Congress should play?
Well, absolutely. But if you bring legitimate issues that people can actually put their teeth into, you can address it that way. But all we hear is rhetoric and saber rattling, right? Everybody wants to find something that doesn't exist out there. And that's not the way to legislate. You know, if, in fact, there is a legitimate position and a legitimate charge that is founded with substantiating data, then let's go ahead and follow the due courses of law. But lacking that, just to be able to have a fire, just because you want to have a fire, I think is disingenuous.
Congresswoman Custer, to you now. Back during the 2012 campaign, you were approached by a Republican staffer with a video camera who was trying to ask you a question. You responded by grabbing the camera and can be heard using some coarse language. Given your personal experience being confronted by a political opponent, what do you believe to be the appropriate balance between protest and civil engagement in the current era?
Well, that was more attack. No, I think the civil protest is what it's all about. And thousands of women came forward who had been sexually assaulted because it was clear that the Senate committee was going to just ram through a candidate without hearing the charges. And these were serious allegations. And the point is that a person going on a lifetime appointment to the United States Supreme Court should have the highest degree of moral fortitude and should have the temperament and the demeanor. So the people that I heard from were shocked by the way the Senate handled the hearing, by how rude they were. And they were very taken by Dr. Blasey Ford and her testimony because it rang true in their lives. So tens of thousands of people were protesting because they felt they weren't being heard. They felt that this group of senators, six of whom had voted against the Violence Against Women Act, were not representative of their democracy. And that's why they came forward. And I thought it was a very civil protest, and it was a very important part of the discourse.
Just to clarify, though, with regard to, you know, people approaching individual lawmakers, how do you feel about that?
I don't have a problem with it. If I hadn't been attacked in the face, I probably would have not responded. Obviously, we have people around all the time, and that's not the problem. I don't know why people couldn't handle having a conversation in a restaurant. Well, I don't know why senators couldn't handle having a conversation in an elevator or in the hall. We're approached all the time. It's a very emotional issue for people who have been sexually assaulted and haven't been heard. And I think it's about time that the Republican Party wake up to it.
Well, let's turn to climate change. And as both of you know, the United Nations presented a dire report on climate change just recently, basically saying there's less time than previously thought to prevent the most dangerous scenarios of warming, more severe storms, more droughts, rapid sea level rise. This question comes from a listener, Scott, who asks, what, if anything, do you think Congress should do about climate change? And Congresswoman Custer, you get it first, please.
Well, thank you, Scott, because it's the most important issue we face. And I'm absolutely shocked that the Republican Party, President Trump, Mr. Negron, deny the science behind the changes in our climate and are refusing to take action. We need to reduce our carbon footprint. That's the bottom line. New Hampshire, luckily, and New England have done that through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that's very, very effective. But we need to take that a step further, make that a national program. And I think what we really need to do is invest and increase our involvement in renewable energy, become carbon free. We have wonderful opportunities. It grows jobs, it grows the economy, and we still have a slim chance to save our planet.
Scott, our listener also asks if you think the U.S. should rejoin the Paris Climate Accord.
Absolutely. I think it was a tremendous mistake for President Trump to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. And I think other countries and indeed companies around the globe, our Pentagon, other institutions, universities, states, and cities recognize that, and it was a grave mistake.
Well, and same question from Scott to you, Representative Negron. What, if anything, Scott asks, do you think Congress should do about climate change?
Absolutely. And again, thank you, Scott, for the question. You know, I don't think anybody disagrees that things have changed. You know, it's really funny. I like to watch the weather when I talk about the hottest days and the coldest days, and it always strikes me that some of the hottest days that we've seen in this country are back from 1912. So I'm not so sure about the heat that we're talking about. But, you know, we do know that things change. You know, we do take proactive issues. I know from the Pentagon, you know, we make sure that there are no companies using ozone-depleting substances. So we are smart. We are doing some things that are out there. And we need to have good, candid conversations. My only pushback is that, you know, I'm not so sure that it is as dire as people are talking about. But let's get the smart people and let's figure out what it is. You know, if you listen to some previous presidential candidates, the ice cap should have melted by now. So let's not make this thing such a scary adventure. Let's bring people together. And are there those things that we can do, like we've done with the ODS, that we can do some things out there that are smart going forward?
I think a lot of climate scientists would say the smart people have already spoken at
sure.
the UN. All the world's right. leading climate scientists have said, A, this is a problem. B, mankind is involved. So I just wonder, again, from Scott,
right.
what's the next step forward, given that the so-called smart people have
sure.
already spoken?
And I think there's some other people on the other side that have very spirited discussions. I think if there's an issue that's out there that needs to be addressed, I think we need to address it. I just don't think it's as draconian as some people make it out, that the sky is falling. Those issues that we found that we needed to take charge and change, we have. And that dialogue still has to keep on moving forward.
And again, to Scott's follow-up, should the U.S. rejoin the Paris Climate Accord?
No, ma'am.
Okay. We will move on from there to what is often everyone's favorite part of our forums, and that's the lightning round. Here we'll cover a series of questions that we had a lot of fun coming up with. And as the name lightning implies, we'd like you to answer them quickly in just a few words. Yes or no is great. So here we go. You ready?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So Representative Negron, Congresswoman Custer, do you support the federal legalization of marijuana? Yes or no?
No.
No.
Okay. Should the federal government help cover the cost of hiker rescues in the White Mountain National Forest? As you know, this is a proposal from some New Hampshire lawmakers. Congressman Custer?
Yes.
No.
Okay. You guys are really good.
What is your favorite hike in New Hampshire, Representative Negron?
Mount Shannon on Griswold Scott Reservation.
I would say Mispah Hut.
Okay. Congresswoman Custer, to you first, this next one. Name a Republican currently serving in Congress whom you admire.
Oh, there are many, but most recently, my colleague from Bradley, I'm just blanking on his last name, who was worked on the sexual assault, the Me Too Congress Act, and he did a wonderful job working with my colleague Jackie Speier from California. And I think it was a really important that the House passed it in a completely bipartisan way on
so
a suspension.
Congressman Bradley.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you remember what state he's from?
Yes. It's down in the South.
That's
and
all right.
I want to say Alabama.
<That's okay. laughs> And Representative Negron, similar question for you. Name a Democrat currently serving in the state legislature whom you admire.
The state legislature?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Since she's serving in Congress,
oh, sure.
And that's where you had served or are serving.
Sue Newman, Representative Sue Newman from Nashua.
Democrat from Nashua.
Yep.
Okay.
She was my first realtor.
Okay.
Sorry.
Fair enough.
Sorry.
And clearly she sold you a house that
yes,
you
like. Yes, she did.
It's a small state. Do you support congressional term limits? And Representative Negron, that's for you first.
Yes, ma'am, I do.
No.
Okay. Federal agents have been conducting immigration checkpoints in New Hampshire within what's called the 100-mile border zone. Congresswoman Custer, you first. Do you think this zone should be narrower, wider, or stay the same?
Narrower. I don't think we want to create a police state here in New Hampshire.
Representative Negron?
Yes, I agree with it. It should stay the same.
Stay the same?
Yes.
Okay. This one is from a listener. What will be your first piece of legislation that you'll submit if elected? And Representative Negron, that's two first, please.
Absolutely. Well, we all know about the Amber Law that's out there, and I think that needs to be expanded, and some states have done it. It's called the Green Law. So we have veterans out there that sometimes they go missing because of a lot of issues, and I think that we have the infrastructure in place to do that, and I would put forward a Green Law that help our veterans that sometimes need to be found as well.
To be missing veterans?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Congresswoman Custer, piece of legislation.
It would be the bill that I've introduced that gives a tax credit for job training and workforce development to small businesses right here in New Hampshire and across the country.
Okay. Congresswoman Custer, you first on this next one. Who is your favorite New Hampshire author?
I guess you would say, I'm thinking of Tommy DiPaolo.
It's kind of unfair when somebody gets one like that one first. I appreciate that. You need a little time to think.
I had somebody else in mind, but they were controversial.
It doesn't get less controversial than Strega Nona, so I hear you on that. Representative Negron, your favorite New Hampshire author?
Tommy DiPaolo.
Okay. We have bipartisan
we're
agreement.
We're on the same territory.
That's awesome.
I hope he's flattered.
This last lightning round question goes to you, Representative Negron. First, it's a cooking question. What dish do you make the best?
Steak and rice and beans.
Okay. Congressman Custer.
We'll have to ask Brad, but I made beef stew last night. So.
All right. Well, you both passed the lightning round with flying colors. Thank you very, very much. And coming up, we will talk about gun legislation. And also, we'll hear the candidates question each other. So Congresswoman Custer, Representative Negron will get a chance to ask the other a question. And then they'll have 60 seconds to respond. So stay with us for a lot more from the Democratic and Republican nominees for New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
Two barrels, found 300 feet apart, containing a total of 4 unidentified bodies.
Why wasn't that barrel found?
We don't know.
A cold case that went nowhere for 30 years.
I'm sure she fought.
That's a big...
I have to believe that she fought.
Available now from NHPR, Bear Brook, a podcast about a cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever. Learn more at bearbrookpodcast.org.
Welcome back to our candidate forum with the Republican and Democratic nominees for New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District, Republican State Representative Steve Negron and incumbent Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with NHPR's Casey McDermott. And Casey, next question is from you, please.
Sure. Representative Negron, you've defended your decision not to support a ban on conversion therapy for LGBTQ youth. But a number of major medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, have denounced conversion therapy, saying it can cause long-term harm to children. How do you square that perspective from medical experts with your vote against banning the practice?
Right. You know, just like any legislation, you have to look at the bill in its totality. And so when I voted against it, when you looked at then the reason I voted against it is that it took the right of a parent to seek the right treatment for his or her child. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. I think a parent has a responsibility, whether or not with or without the medical community, that's my child, and I know what's best for my child, and I should be able to have a decision process in that. And that bill took that right away from me as a parent, and that's why I voted against it.
Would you support a modified version of the bill, taking into account some of that expert perspective?
Absolutely. I think if you looked at that bill and you looked at what they were trying to do, there were some things in there that absolutely should not be done, clearly. But when it's all boiled down to one, and as a parent, you know, if there was an opportunity for us to relook at that bill and make it a better bill, I would absolutely entertain it. But, you know, I get very defensive when somebody in the government tries to tell me as a parent what I can't do with my child.
Next up to Congresswoman Custer, looking more broadly at your campaign finance records, you've raised more than $3 million toward your reelection campaign, including about a third of that from PACs. Some of your top contributors include major insurers, financial firms, other corporations. What do you say to voters who might question your ability to represent the interests of everyday citizens when so much of your money comes from these groups?
Well, most of our money comes from individuals here in New Hampshire and around the country, and I'm definitely proud of that. And the point is, we need comprehensive campaign finance, and that's one of the first bills that Democrats will bring in January if we win back the House in November. And what's important about that is that the program that we have is transparent. You can see it. You can look at the records. It doesn't impact my voting, but these are expensive elections. The Koch brothers spent $4 million against me in 2014, and I'm going to defend the people in this state against that outside money. What is going unregulated is the dark money, the millions of dollars that are being spent by Republicans, corporations, Koch brothers, and others that has no transparency and no accountability whatsoever at all. And so that's what we're going to do. It's called We the People, and it's a set of reforms that will reform our campaign finance, and I very much look forward to that system.
Are you saying that there is no dark money on the Democratic side, Congresswoman?
Not coming into New Hampshire, no.
Not coming into New Hampshire. So to address what Casey said, some Republicans and some Democrats have said, I'm a little concerned about all that big corporate money that the Congresswoman is getting. And I'm just wondering how you can reassure people to follow up on what
you
said.
What you need to understand is those PAC contributions are limited. They're $5,000 in the primary and the general, and they're from individuals. They're from employees. So I'm proud to have the support. Let me use the example of Fidelity that has 5,000 employees here in my district, and that those people have come forward and pooled their resources and that they support my reelection. I'm proud of that. I don't have any problem with that.
I'd like to turn to the issue of guns, gun violence, gun control. This has been a big issue during this election season. And Congresswoman Custer, to you first, in February, you called for, quote, meaningful common sense solutions after the Parkland school shootings. You said the right approach protects both school children and the rights of responsible gun owners. Can you give us one example of an approach that achieves both those objectives, protecting the rights of responsible gun owners, but also protecting our kids?
Sure. And there are many examples, by the way. Look, I've talked to gun owners. I've talked to teachers. I've talked to people in the community. We have an epidemic of violence that we need to control. And one way to do that is to fortify our schools, but a much more important way to do that is to provide mental health treatment and to limit the risk from these high-capacity guns that are really threatening people. I had a great suggestion the other day, right after our forum, from a gun owner who approached me. He's a responsible gun owner. He belongs to a gun club. And he said, why don't we use those weapons that we might enjoy in the gun club, and so that they're locked and they're cared for. And I think that's what we want to work with gun owners that are responsible on keeping these weapons safe. But right now, we've got a real epidemic of violence that threatens people, not just in schools, that's heartbreaking, but in movie theaters, in churches, in nightclubs. And we've got to address this level of violence around the country.
Once you start saying, let's ban this type of gun or that type of gun, you mentioned high-capacity magazines.
And I'm not talking about banning, by the way. What he was talking about is having them locked in the gun club, and so that people can use them, because I've met many people in New Hampshire who enjoy that as a sport, as a form of recreation. This is what they enjoy. And by the way, I certainly support the Second Amendment for protecting your children in your home and for hunting. And this is a long history in New Hampshire.
So you're not saying ban certain types of weapons like high-capacity magazines?
What I'm talking about is let's find a middle ground. I think this whole issue has been far too polarized, and we haven't had a middle ground. We haven't had solutions that are widely acceptable. What we do know is that most gun owners have as much concern about these school shootings as any other citizen. And let's try to meet them halfway, find a way that they feel comfortable. But things like background checks, that's not going to be a problem for responsible gun owners in New Hampshire. We can improve upon that. The no-fly, no-buy. If you're a terrorist, you can't fly on an airplane. You shouldn't be able to walk into a gun store. And I know the Republican talking points love to talk about MS-13. I don't think an MS-13 terrorist should be able to walk into a gun store and buy a gun. So no fly, no buy is another example.
Well, and let's talk about background checks. And to you, Representative Negron, please. Federal law requires licensed firearms dealers to perform background checks on prospective purchasers, but doesn't require unlicensed sellers to do so, although some states do require these unlicensed sellers to conduct background checks. Should all gun sales, no matter who is selling, be subject to background checks?
Well, you look at the current laws that we have out there, and I just want to make a comment. You know, when these unfortunate circumstances happen, like Parkland, they want to throw the majority of us as gun owners are just that, the majority. It's just these few that have, in my mind, I think there's some mental issues that that have to be addressed. And we actually look at the instrument, and then you throw the whole situation at the feet of the majority instead of throwing it at the feet where it belongs, and that's for that shooter. And we need to do better at that. We need to understand what that situation was, what drove that individual to take that action that I was only recourse. So when you start figuring out, you know, what it is as a law-abiding citizen, a law-abiding gun owner, we have the laws on the books today. I think nothing has to change. I am a proponent of a national reciprocity law. But you know what? We have to put the blame and the responsibility at the feet of the individuals, and those are those people that are perpetrating these horrific acts.
If that individual who wants to perpetrate an act did want to purchase a gun from a friend, from a gun show, he or she wouldn't have to go through a background check. Should he or she have to go through a background check, no matter where he or she gets the gun?
Well, you have to look at the law today, right?
If we're going to focus on the individual.
Sure. There are specific situations where individuals are not allowed to purchase a weapon. Those are the laws that we have in the book today. And that's why we call ourselves law-abiding citizens, law-abiding gun owners. So if somebody's out there that's going to break the law by purchasing a weapon when he or she doesn't have the right to do that, then we need to enforce the law that are on the books. I'm a firm believer that the Second Amendment is one of the 10 that's out there, and we're on a slippery slope when we're trying to find these little off-ramps to give certain individuals different rights that other people have.
So should all gun sales be subject to background checks?
Well, if you look at right now, when I go and I purchase from an FFL dealer or a gun store, I actually do run a background
check.
Absolutely.
But there's other instances where you wouldn't have to, depending on the seller. So should all gun sales be subject to background checks, no matter who is the seller?
No, I don't think that.
Another question about background checks. When a licensed dealer, as you know, as a gun owner, requests a background check, the FBI has to complete it in 3 days. If that process for some reason takes the FBI longer, the person is able to purchase the gun. Gun control advocates have called this the Charleston loophole because it allowed Dylan Roof to buy the gun he used to kill 9 churchgoers in South Carolina. Should the FBI, Representative Negron, have more time to conduct such background checks?
Well, maybe the system needs to be more robust, right? A lot of times when you're asking the FBI to do these background checks, through whatever reasons, maybe they don't have the ability to actually conduct those within the 3 days, I would look at making sure the FBI has all the rights and the ability to do those background checks in the current 3 days that the law prescribes.
Well, at this point in our forum, we'd like to give you each the opportunity to ask each other a question. Please keep your questions short. Each candidate will get a minute to respond. And Representative Negron, you get to go first asking Congresswoman Custer a question, please.
Absolutely. Congresswoman, I would just ask, you know, as we walked through the primary and locked on a lot of doors, that there was a sense that they didn't feel that you came back as much to the district as maybe as you should, and that you certainly are a prolific fundraiser and you do those things in Washington. Is there a reason why you don't come back as much to the 2nd Congressional District and hear what they have to say? And just to follow up is that, you know, you voted against the tax package, but what I hear is that helped over probably 90% of the people in New Hampshire, and they're kind of saying to me at the door, you know, if she had come and listened to me, she would have known that tax package benefited me. Can you answer that?
Sure. No, I'm happy to. The truth is that I'm home every single weekend. In fact, I'm only spending 3.5 days in Washington, so I fly down on Mondays. I'm home on Thursdays, and I'm in the district all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and every week that we have off, and the month of August I was here, all over the district. So I think you'll find I get around the district, and we do town halls, we do forums, we've had literally hundreds of Congress in your company visits and town hall meetings and forums on opioids and veterans. So I'm more than happy to share the schedule with you, but trust me, I get around the district. The second part of your question about the tax bill, what I've heard is that people are shocked that millionaires and billionaires got a tax break that they didn't need, corporations that have now used that money into stock buybacks, and that it's the middle class that's going to pay for it. And the reason is that we've increased under President Trump, this is in the news today, the deficit is going to be reaching $1 trillion next year. And we've added $1.5 trillion to the debt. And that is going to be the burden for years to come. And it's all for the benefit of millionaires and billionaires.
All right. And Congresswoman Custer, you get a chance to ask Representative Negron a question now, please.
Sure. So, Representative Negron, I was an adoption attorney for 25 years. And I've talked to many, many people with unplanned pregnancies. You are opposed to abortion in all circumstances, with no exception for the life of the mother, rape, or incest. What is the mechanism that you would use to force a woman to carry a pregnancy to term against her will or if her life was in danger?
Thank you for the question. You know, we're a culture of life and not a culture of death, and we absolutely can do better. You know, and in my experience, for every person, uncategorically, every woman that I've ever known that has gone through that procedure has regretted it because it was a situation where they felt that they had no other recourse.
Can you respond in terms of the mechanism that you would use, that you suggest the government, if a woman was pregnant and her life was in danger, what is the mechanism that you would use to make sure she carried the pregnancy to term?
And let's start the clock over for 60 seconds for Mr. Negron.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think, and you look in today's advancement of medical technology, you know, I think it's the rare instance where somebody has to make a choice of a life. And so, first of all, I don't think the federal government should dictate to the states or to a woman to legislate that it's okay. Certainly, I don't believe that federal money should be going to those entities that do those kind of procedures. And as I said at the beginning, you know, we can do better than that. You know, we can do the situation where we have to let those people know that there are options for them, that, you know, taking the life isn't the only thing that's out there. I'm very sympathetic.
Would you require that
Congressman
be
Custer,
in jail?
Let's let him.
I'm just trying to get him to answer
no.
the question.
Yeah,
sorry.
Well, he's answering it however he sees fit, right. And we need to let him finish out his minute, please.
Sure. Let me just give you an example to help answer this question. When my aunt was pregnant with my cousin in 1965, she contracted German measles. And at that time, the doctors told her that she should terminate the pregnancy because it was going to be a difficult pregnancy and the child would probably be born with birth defects. My aunt did not do that. My aunt decided that life was more important. And so my cousin Margarita was born. And yes, she had complications. She was deaf. She was dumb. She couldn't. She had holes in her heart. She was blind in one eye. But the decision that my aunt made brought that life into this world, and I had such a relationship with my cousin. And if you do something other than that, that experience, that ability for that person to have a life for however long it was, and she lived for 35 years, and I was a pallbearer at her funeral. And when we laid her in the ground, one of the things that I remember saying, because my aunt asked me to say some words, is that she had a difficult life. It was a beautiful life. It was a life of love. It was a life of experiences. And that's the opportunity that I think every child needs to have. You know, if my aunt had decided something different, I wouldn't have had the relationship I had with my cousin. So my perspective, Congresswoman, is that we can do better than taking a life. And I believe that that's the way we should be going down the road.
Well, and one last question for both of you and responses for just 30 seconds, please, because we're running to the end of our forum. Hard to believe. And this last question comes from my colleague, Casey McDermott. So go ahead, Casey.
So we've seen a number of racially charged incidents here at home and around the country in the last year or so. Governor Sununu's launched a diversity task force on the issue. My question is, as a member of Congress, what message would come from your office about this issue? And Representative Negron, to you first.
Absolutely. Being Hispanic and being a minority and growing up, I remember I came back to Oklahoma, which wasn't as diverse as some of the other places that I lived. You know, everybody has a right. Everybody is just as important as the next person. And in growing up in the military, you know, we didn't have different colors, different race, religions. Even though we did it, we never identified with that. So from my office, everybody is equal. Everybody. We would treat everybody with dignity and respect. And it starts with me because I think that's where the leadership comes from. And so my office would absolutely be open to making sure that we include diversity.
And Congresswoman Custer, to you.
Absolutely. And we have all kinds of diversity in our office, but I was particularly proud to have an Afghan refugee who grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, went to the University of New Hampshire, and did a fabulous job for us in our outreach here in New Hampshire. And he's now gone on to the State Department. And so I look at the opportunity for all different kinds of people, whoever they love, whatever their background. We have a very diverse staff, and I'm very proud of it. It's a great stepping stone for them in their career path.
Well, hard to believe it has flown by. We have run out of time. This concludes our forum with the 2nd Congressional District Republican and Democratic nominees. A big, big thanks to my colleagues here at NHPR for all their work putting this event together, especially for this forum, my colleague reporter Casey McDermott. Thank you also to our audience and to our candidates, Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer and State Representative Steve Negron. Both of you, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.